Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to another edition of Bioactive Live Q&A. We're switching gears this week, kind of changing paces. We went through some heavy information last week, in case you didn't notice the get up here. Doing the Elton John this week because of the blue light, the NNEMF. And if you missed last week's episode, it's life-changing, so definitely check that out. My name is Mark. I am your host here tonight. As always, with me, I've got Brian from Rubber Ducky Isopods, Kevin from OK Calyx, and we got a real special guest, definitely a pioneer in the arid game of reptiles rearing and information. Welcome to the show, Phil, from Arids Only.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us tonight, and can't wait to show off what it is that you do, what it is that you raise, and kind of go through, you know, the nuances of switching into bioactive on from an arid side, and kind of having a good conversation on what that really means, what those challenges are, and yeah, super excited to have you. So tonight, we're going to switch gears up a little bit. Brian, since he's the specialist in that side of the operation of reptiles, bioactive enclosures, all that fun stuff, he's going to run the first part with the interview. But guys, remember that this is a Q&A, so we're looking for your questions. I know people are going to be trickling in here, and we'll remind you guys as we go, but make sure you drop those questions in for Phil. If you've got questions about gardening and stuff, we'll definitely get to those as well. But we'd certainly want to talk more with Phil and his specialty, which is rearing chuckwallas, Euromastis, sticks, Xenigmas, and Saromalis.
Yeah.
Brian, I'm going to turn it over to you, brother. And thank you, guys.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Mark. And this is going to be a fun one, obviously, Kevin, because these are kind of like Mark was saying, in my world, like, who are the people that are kind of at the forefront of doing this kind of stuff? And I don't know anything, especially these last, you know, 3 years ago. So I just watch and observe, especially at the beginning. And I've watched as the time has gone. I've been invited to some lunches that I felt like were pretty exclusive, if you will. And of course, Phil is there. And so Philip Leeds, to me, is somebody that I see as kind of, from a bioactive, I hope he kind of like more gets into this, because he could be a real leader into that kind of industry. The way that he kind of carries himself, I could see a lot of people wanting to learn to mimic some of these are basically dinosaurs. I don't feel like I'm wrong saying that, right, Phil? I mean, as close as you can get to raising a dinosaur in 2024. So this kind of stuff is unique. And so what I'm getting at here is, when I was going around to these expos, especially in the early days with the cannabis stuff, right, you start to see, like, well, who are the people that are interested in some of these breeders? Because you know some of the bigger names in town. So what line are they standing in? And so that kind of stuff I've always kind of translated into the reptile space. And I noticed just a couple of months ago that Philip had all of the big names, at least in that the area that day, were checking out his stuff and kind of sitting there and wanting to talk to him. And I was sitting there chatting it up with him, and I saw the people coming back and forth, the big names, just kind of wanting to see what he has. And I noticed that a lot of people don't really do that, man. So you have found a niche that we kind of talk about here on every Friday night, that eventually, as being an entrepreneur, you eventually just kind of run into something. You stumble into something, you find success with it, and then you're able to run with it. And that's you're in such a unique thing. That's why I asked the boys, Kevin and Mark, to have you on the show, is because this kind of stuff is where you can kind of just change your stars, Phil. Like, if you grew up in a shitty area, man, grew up with the hard stuff, how am I able to do and make money in a legal sense? And for a lot of us that grew up in a certain way, it's very hard to achieve that without a college education. I got kids. I know you just had a baby boy. So yep. Congratulations on that. We're all parents here on the show tonight. So there's a lot of stress that comes with that. And so what I was learning from you as I was preparing for this interview is that it kind of came from that same sense. You said your dad was letting you in the early days breed bearded dragons, especially from a bioactive standpoint, man. When you don't have that, that stinks to high heaven. So your dad obviously loved you enough and wanted to allow you to have the basement Really loved you because that shit stinks, man. Especially when I first got a bearded dragon, it's almost unbearable. So to have a bunch of them and breeding them, and I saw that you eventually kind of moved into more of, I saw that you were getting, I think it was the Euro Mystics. You were saying that you used a credit card. It was about $3,200, which obviously in a business standpoint, that's the dumbest thing you could ever do is put it on a credit card. But that's what I mean. Like from an entrepreneur standpoint, you're just trying to put the pieces together. You don't necessarily know this stuff as you're early. And that's kind of also what I'm going to get with this show, man, is that being an entrepreneur and putting these things together, you're doing it in real time. You're putting it all together while you're running and juggling, bro. That's kind of how this stuff works. And what I've found from you, man, is that you figured these things out early. You were even kind of joking around that you felt like you were being like almost like a little kid when you were kind of going through this stuff. I think you even mentioned that your father at one point was kind of like, all right, where are we going? Girlfriend started to ask you, all right, what's going on here? You're spending all this money on this stuff. Why can't you take me out on a vacation? And so that's what I kind of want to get at, man, is entrepreneurs give up so much stuff to get to a certain point. And from that standpoint, you were willing to believe in yourself enough to put $3,200 on animals that obviously could die pretty easily and run with basically mini dinosaurs. And so that's where I wanted to kind of kick off this show tonight is with a mini intro, because obviously nobody in the cannabis space has learned about you yet. And I think you're one of us in a weird way, man. And the fact that I really see you as you're just trying to find your way. You're bumping through life. You have a child, you have a family now, and it seems like you're really focused. You're on breeding dinosaurs, and let's kick it off from there.
Yeah, sure. So that's all. Also, by the way, that was super nice to say. Some of that stuff, I should say, is kind of intriguing because you mentioned me, putting that first purchase of $3,200 on a credit card, which was, that was a pair of Euromastix Thomasi, which is the Omani Euromastix. I've got those. A whole mess of those on the gram, just FYI. There's a recent one too, or you could be able to scroll through the pictures there, but there was a recent post with some Thomasi too, if that's easier. There you go. That's Euromastix Thomasi. And so they're a pretty rare lizard out of Oman, and I had known about them, and an opportunity came up to buy them. And I was not in any way doing this as a business or anything at that time. I was just like, all right, forget it. Like, I want to get these animals. Like, let's give it a shot. And so I buy them. A couple of years later, I managed to breed them. That was the first Euromastix species that I was able to breed, even though I had been keeping them for a long time. And, you know, the first couple of years after when I hatched them, I was also working with a handful of gecko species at the time. And I was able to sell some stuff and wasn't paying all the bills or anything, but I noticed, I was like, I can pay some bills with this. Like I can at the very least cover all of the expenses around the animals, the power, the food, you know, all that stuff. And, but I also realized I could also make money. You know, I could sell I noticed that, if you scale it up, you could conceivably turn it into a business. Now, admittedly, I was a little unclear on that. You know, I never thought I would be a business owner or of any kind. It just never struck me as something that I would drift towards. But then I, had a couple of nice phone conversations with some people who were already in the field, who had sold me some animals and were super kind to me with their time and everything. And they kind of encouraged me, towards doing it. They were like, oh yeah, no, you can totally make a living doing this. And, I'm not sure why I had never really noticed that previously, but I did, I did at this point. And so I'm glad these guys told me. And, I just built real slow, right? I started in an apartment that I was living in and then moved back in with my family not long after that, after a breakup, and, took a couple of trips, started expanding the reptile operation, a little bit, little by little. Had a really interesting coffee meetup with a guy who does this down in Florida. And, just got another boost of encouragement from him that was like, no, dude, you can totally do this. Like this, you're already doing a good job with the animals you produce. It's obvious you're doing a good work. So just keep going, and just do more. And I was like, okay. And so, spent just obscene amounts of money on supplies from a cabinet making company that would cut the wood for me to build out, you know, 50 cages, and then ordered all the lights wholesale, the fixtures, just started building it out. I ripped up the carpet in my family's basement to seal the floor so it wasn't dirtying the carpet and being super gross. And, you know, just kind of went, you know, one step at a time. When I was presented with something I needed to do or change, I would change it. Admittedly, I never thought that much about, you know, the future or, you know, where things would go. It was, you know, they were very direct, relatively immediate goals. So it was a lot of, well, you know, I want to breed this, you know, I want to try to produce these species next year. I want to try to produce more of this species next year. How do I hold this back and you know, grow the crew? And, you know, because this was, you know, still pretty early days, right? And, you know, at one point or another, it just evolved and turned into most of my income. And then it turned into all of my income. You know, I would do little odd jobs in the off season, like clean windows and gutters and wait tables and stuff. When I wasn't producing much or, you know, during the winter, you name it. And then in 2020, I had an interesting interaction where a disgruntled competitor called Fish and Wildlife on me and was saying that I was working with illegal stuff, and which was not true, never have. And anyway, I had agents show up at my house to say, hey, we got a report that you were doing X, you know, you were selling X, Y, or Z. And it was like, well, you guys, you can come downstairs and see my operation. I've got PACPA license, you know, the whole nine. So I'm pretty above board. And they were like, oh, it's, you know, it's fine, but you know, you probably can't do this out of your home because I don't think it's zoned for it. And that scared the hell out of me. I was really worried that there was a chance I wouldn't be able to continue doing what I do. So I rented a flex warehouse space out here in Colorado and moved my operation into a building. And that was a really scary move for me. You know, I didn't know how it was going to affect the breeding operation. I didn't know anything. I was just really freaked out, you know. Moved into the space, managed through various lucky circumstances to continue paying the bills and doing what I needed to do and just growing that whole operation, just, you know, step or two at a time. And, you know, and then land to now, we're going to be in 2025 and everything's still going smoothly and the animals are producing
You have an employee, correct? I mean, you're kind of being modest here, but it's more than just like, you know, you got a couple animals in a warehouse. I mean, you're moving this stuff here. You have the apex people coming to your booth, and I don't know if you know this, but quietly, maybe even behind your back, saying like, "Wow, your animals are unbelievably gorgeous." The coloring, all of those things. So that's what we kind of want to now pick your brain on is, you know. Bearded dragons are out there. You know, you obviously were doing that when you're younger, but you were in the trenches so much that you knew you wanted to move into this. So how did you kind of build up that business from more of like a breeding standpoint? How are you keeping the coloring?
Yeah.
What, and then we do want to go deeper into the bioactive, because I know that almost every reptile stinks, and I think it's a game changer.
Sure.
If we trade information, if we kind of just build these bridges together.
Yeah,
How long does it take to breed these things also? When you say breed, I have no clue.
Yeah. So let me just cover a couple of bases and then I'll get into a little bit more of how I built it out. So most of the animals I work with take anywhere from 2 to 5 years to mature, you know, from baby to, you know, hatching to sexual maturity. It really can be variable there, but usually about 2 to 5 years, depending on the species. You have to employ seasonal changes, both in temperature and lighting hours and things of that nature. You're changing food and diet yearly or throughout the year, just, you know, dropping it off in the fall, building it up in the spring, trying to just pull as many levers as you can, to encourage the animals to do what they're going to do naturally, which is procreate. So, you know, a lot of that happens, you know, also by way of solo housing and then introduction in the spring for favorable breeding results. That's sort of like the, you know, maybe like a broad overview of how you're getting them to produce. The animals will mate, in the breeding season. They'll gestate for about, you know, 8 weeks, give or take, 2 weeks in either direction, depending on the species. And then they'll, with most of them, with the exception of one live bearing species that I have, they will then lay eggs. You take those eggs out of whatever they've laid them in, which is usually a nest box, and you take those eggs, put them in perlite with a little bit of moisture, put them in an incubator, and then the eggs will hatch, right? So right there, those are some Xenogamma tayloriae eggs that I've just dug up out of the dirt from her nesting box. And then the animals, depending on, again, depending on the species, will take anywhere from 55 to 120 days in the case of some of the tortoises to hatch. And then you rear the babies to get them up to a shipping size or a size where they can tolerate the change in homes. And then you sell them to people wishing to buy those either as pets or as breeding projects of their own. I've worked with various zoos and AZA accredited institutions and a handful of universities here and there who are, you know, just doing various exchanges or what have you for different species. And so that's sort of like the broad overview. Now, how I got into some of the individual ones that I work with, it was mostly just based on personal interest. I always found myself drawn to desert reptiles. And so I just started to choose desert reptiles, you know, number one, that they had to interest me. And then eventually all of them interest you. And so that kind of goes out the door, right? So then what you do is you move into the, I'm going to choose animals that not only are really interesting to me, but maybe have a couple of other matching characteristics outside of being desert animals. That's sporadic importation, right? So they're not consistently or in large numbers brought into the pet trade. In the case of Euromastix, you can see 2 or 3, 4 years where a species is being imported with regularity, and then that importation just dries up overnight, and then they're not in for another 10 years, 20 years sometimes. So those are the things that really intrigued me. I loved seeing these sort of like undervalued or underrepresented animals, you know, give them enough care, show how cool they can be, and then produce them and help make them, you know, like available here in herpetoculture. So the other characteristic I always ended up looking for was, are there lots of other people breeding them? You know, because if there's tons of people breeding them, then maybe that wasn't that interesting to me, not because it wasn't cool or anything like that, but I'm just sort of drawn to a challenge. You know, I like when somebody says, oh, I don't think those have ever been produced in captivity. To me, that sounds like I could do it. You know, it's maybe a little bit of arrogance mixed with naivete, right? So that's kind of how I choose the animals broadly. And then I've also added in a little bit of, would they make interesting projects and pets inside herpetoculture? Would people be interested in them? Because I think there might be an unethical slant to producing something that nobody's really interested in, right? Because then you're sort of producing animals that might not go anywhere and might not actually get a home. And there's sort of like a weird ethical quandary breeding those things. In terms of like their coloration and their general appearance, that almost all of that goes into, number one, good photography, right? Because most animals are gorgeous in their healthy, fully actualized forms. They're all beautiful in their own way. So a lot of it is just learning how to take good photos and show them off in a way that captures sort of what's already present in the animal, but really high quality care. So you're making sure you're getting all your parameters correct as close as you can get to ideal. That's going to allow their natural beauty to show through. And then it's just a simple matter of taking good photos. So I also like to choose animals that are gorgeous, right? So in the case of the image that's on the screen right now, this is a hatchling ornate Euromastix. This is sort of the species that I put most of my effort into and tends to be the most popular with regard to just demand and sales, but there's lots of others as well. So I just like animals that are just stunning and interesting because to me, it just seemed, you know, there's some that where you look at them and they just seem like an obvious win, you know, in the case of an ornate Euromastix, and very few people, you know, plenty of people had produced them, but very few people had produced the numbers in terms of, you know, like just the total number of animals that I'm producing. Nobody had done that. Nobody is, you know, at this level. Very few, if any, people had produced them for more than a couple of one or two generations indoors, or in captivity. And so, you know, I'm now on generation like five, coming up on six in the next couple of years. And, you know, that's a big bump and that's hard to do. And so then all of these themes that come out of what I'm really interested in and sort of the results of learning about these animals then informs some of the other stuff that I end up being interested in, which is how to understand how to make them really, really happy psychologically. Number two, how to ensure that they have long, fulfilling lives indoors, you know, and how do you help other people who are really interested in these things have an easier entry point where it's not so because with most of the stuff, as I said, if it's imported very rarely and isn't produced that much, there's very likely to be limited information on those animals. So how do I make it so those people, one says care guides and one says care guides 2.0 is because one's like the link to download the PDF. And then one is like the care guides on the web. Just, you can scroll down on the site and see them. So just FYI. So, you know, normally there wouldn't be a lot of information about some of this stuff. And so I try to put all that information out there and offer updates. So the care guides that I've written all will be regularly updated as I learn more, as I understand more and, you know, make mistakes and find ways of fixing them, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, that's sort of the long and the short of how I make certain choices and how I've gotten to kind of this point in what I do.
And you're at the forefront of this stuff. So I just wanted to let that to the audience. Kevin has a question for you. Yeah. I do want people to know that you're at, as far as I understand it, really the tippy top of trying to understand this stuff and from your experience then sharing that. So Kevin, go ahead and ask that.
Thanks.
Sir?
Yeah. So how common is it for a typical person who, you know, would have a reptile? How common is it for them to have one of these, I don't even know how to pronounce it, heuristics?
Euromastics. Yeah.
Euromastics.
So they, no, not especially, right? Some of them, you know, like the Saharan species, the Euromastics jayrii, they're maybe a little more present. People see them regularly at shows and pet shops because they are imported a lot, or they were up until recently. And so they're around, you know, a lot of people kind of have, you know, if you, most people who aren't familiar with reptiles have never seen a Euromastics. But within reptiles, there's probably, I don't know, maybe 50-50 toss up. I get, you know, when I brought these to, say, for example, the expo where I met Brian, I met him at the lunch before that, but where Brian and I were at that expo in Castle Rock together. I'd say 50% of the people who came to my table had seen them or heard of them. And then 50% had just didn't even know they existed. So it's kind of all over the place. You know, you do meet people who have them and just maybe bought an import a little while ago or something like that, but it's pretty rare to see them. They're not like good, you know, they're nowhere near as common as like a, you know, ball python, bearded dragon, corn snake, crested gecko, leopard gecko, that stuff. Nowhere near that. Yeah. Yeah.
The snakes are dime a dozen, bro.
I have another question, Phil.
Sure. Yeah, please.
That tail,
I'm gonna
ask the question now. What's the purpose of the weird tail? The one that's really fat, round, and kind of got the points on it. To that, because it's
absolutely
so
unique. Yeah, yeah. So many of them, the general it's multi-purpose, but the primary one is they use their tails as a burrow, as like a little door on their burrow. So when they burrow into the dirt, they'll dig in enough to about bury their body or a little past that. And then the shield of their tail acts as a barrier and seals the hole basically. So it's harder to get in for stuff that's trying to bite them. But it also, in this case, this is a Xenogamma taylori, shield tailed agama. These guys, the little stringy end on the tail, they'll wriggle it at one another as like a communication tool during breeding and territorial display. And then some of the others, some of the species have like a semi-prehensile tail where they can grip with it because they climb a lot, both on rocks and on small trees and shrubs. So they'll use it to kind of help, you know, steer and balance, right? They'll also, some of the ones with the longer tails, like the bigger Euromastics and the ornates and stuff, Egyptians, Moroccans, Bandits, they'll all use it also to hit and defense. They'll swing it and hit you with it, right? When you pick them up, if they're very angry and they didn't want, like this one, this is a Moroccan Euromastix. You pick them up and they don't want to be touched. They'll actively dig the tail spines into your hand. They'll drive their tail against you to poke you with those spines and try to get you to let them go. So the tails serve many purposes. You know, most like much like anything, it's you know, pretty rare when stuff only serves one purpose. Anyway.
Yeah. The belly is so big.
Yeah.
Do they eat a lot? What's the reason for that huge belly, maybe?
Yeah. So many of these lizards, like the Euromastix, like Chuckwallas, some of these others, they will they'll look almost overweight sometimes. And that's because the other feature of these animals is they can dive into crevices and small spaces because they can compress themselves very thin. And then what happens is when they get into that crevice or space, many lizards will do this, but they will then inflate their body with air. And what that does is prevent animals and predators from extracting them from those crevices. So that's one reason. Another is it just has to, you know, it's just got to do with how they're built, and they have a long digestive tract because they're mostly herbivores. And so well, for the most part, they are modestly omnivorous, but the bulk of their diet is plants and vegetation and very fibrous stuff. So you can think of them in, you know, sort of similar to the way you would a tortoise or some kind of hindgut fermenter, like a cow, like a grazer, you know? So that's another reason. Yeah. Yeah.
No, really good answers, man. Thank you.
Of course. Yeah.
So it comes, obviously there's a lot of, you know, you have the care guides, you have this stuff. We have these, we call them gold bars on our show. And a lot of this stuff, especially when we're talking even from like Kevin's point of view, Mark has that. I've you know, we all kind of contribute. But watching some of your interviews, Phil, I noticed that your gold bar was so simplistic that I wanted to point it out.
Yeah.
Because most of these pictures, you're showing them hanging out in groups. And you were saying in the interview that your secret to success, or at least one of the secrets to success, is that you're keeping them alone, and then you're kind of like allowing them to socialize. Yep. I wanted to dive deeper down that rabbit hole because it sounds so simplistic that I think a lot of people would overlook it. But in the interview, you went into, you explained it well enough where I was like, wow, man, this, you know, however long it took, and then you're talking about something so simplistic. It's kind of the same thing with IMOs and stuff for people that have, in our world with soil and that kind of thing.
Well, I mean, look at all the pictures.
Yeah,
it's, you know what I mean? They're all to
great. Yeah, yeah.
Is this to show mating pairs, or is this to also emphasize that's mainly to show mating
all
pairs?
Mating, because they're all, all their tails are wrapped around each other.
Yeah, great question. And there's a lot here. So, part of the reason that I've documented the mating is because it's a layer of verification that I can show that these animals were produced here at my place, right? Because one of the things you see throughout the animal industry is you see people claiming to have produced things, or, you know, bred things, or, you know, whatever. And then, you know, turns out they were either imports or wild caught, like they weren't actually bred in captivity, or they, the person who claimed to produce them didn't, right? So I see this sort of as a way of verification, that the documentation, so I can then, it, you know, it builds out the resume. It shows like, look, I've produced all these animals. Like I can tell, I promise you I'm breeding them. And it's educational because you're getting context. It's information that's not necessarily shown. But part of why I can capture these photos in the first place is because I keep everything alone. And there's a lot of reasons for that, right? Now, just to be clear, they're not in solitary confinement, right? So they are able at various points throughout the year, I bring them together, not just for breeding, but for socialization and interaction. And, you know, that's just beneficial for them. You don't want to keep them like a psychopath on their own forever. But keeping them solo does a number of things. Number one, if you're trying to breed these things, this is, I think that's one of the biggest things that people will just don't want to do, is house them alone and then do introductory style breeding. Part of the reason that it's a great lever to pull is because when the animals, for the most part, are seeing each other most of the time just to breed, then they're going to be more likely to to understand that when they start seeing each other in the spring, that that's leading into breeding, right? Because seasonally, if you explore these animals in the wild, various, now I haven't seen Uromastix in the wild, but I've seen Chuckwallas and lots of other lizards in the wild. The option, they have the option in the wild to flee each other anytime they need or want. They can get away from one another anytime they like, right? And when you're forcing animals together to be housed together all the time, and if you're not watching them around the clock, you are asking for disaster in one way, shape, or form. And it may not come to you for 10 or 20 years, and then 1 year you lose an animal because it was killed by an aggressive cage mate. If you want to talk about, it helps encourage breeding. It helps ensure that you're getting safety for your animals, so they're not being either directly injured or subject to the constant stress of a cage mate that they're not getting along with. Most people aren't paying enough attention to all of the the interactions subtle signs of aggression in their animals to notice that it might be a problem. And all of that has downstream effects on breeding and long-term health and well-being, right? But when you keep them solo, you're avoiding all of that. Now, a lot of people don't like it also because it means they, in theory, have to have fewer animals because they have to have more cages, right? One of the things that people love about reptiles is having them together, seeing them interact, and having them like ready to breed when they're gonna, and you can keep more animals if you have them in group caging, right? But I just don't think the juice is worth the squeeze. I think that you're gonna get better long-term health, better care for your pets if they're just pets, better results in breeding. If you think about it from a biosecurity perspective, if you have a pathogen enter your collection somehow or a parasite, it's very unlikely to sweep your entire collection if you've got them all in separated caging. So you might get in a few animals because those animals interacted, but it's not going to everyone in the entire facility. So it acts as a layer of safety and, verifiability that, you know, things are going to go well, or that you can control and pay attention to which animals are eating and which animals are not, because if they're housed together, one might be eating all the food, the other might be getting none, and you might not notice until there's a problem. You name it. It also allows you to experiment and control exactly what's happening. So you can say, well, this entire slot of animals over here, I gave them this food item and I saw big improvements in their health. So I'm going to start feeding that to everybody. So it allows you to do small experiments. And it makes sure that you can control pairings and you can be 100% certain who mated with who. So you can keep track of your genetics better. And last but not least, you can make sure that it just allows you to plan better for when they are going to lay eggs, because if you keep them together all the time, you might miss mating and you might not know if the animals grab it or not, right? Or pregnant, right? So if you keep them apart and you see them mating, you can record that and say, okay, I can expect eggs from this female in 6 to 8 weeks. So it allows you to just be more prepared. So you're less likely to lose eggs and less, you know, there's just the benefits of it are just so far reaching. So far reaching, and people sleep on it. And I mean, really, like, they sleep on it. Yeah, that's the solo.
I have another question. You actually answered one of them when you said you can control your genetics or something similar to that. So you referred to these as your genetics. So I was kind of wondering if that's how you would refer to them, like we do with plants and things like that.
Sure.
You know, we could just call our genetics. So do you kind of keep your are your genetics to the point where you're like, I breed my own stuff because it's really good? Or do you introduce new things often?
Yeah, great. Excellent question. So when I said genetics, I was just sort of using it as like a broad blanket term, right? You can, you know, in other words, it just guarantees me that this is the only animal that animal mated with. So that's the father of this offspring, right? It's like a tracking tool. But I really hesitate. So, you know, like the way that would go down in herpetoculture, the nomenclature would be, oh, well, this is my quote line of ornate Uromastix or granite chuckwalla or whatever. But this is something that I talk about with some regularity because there's no hard and fast definition of what it means to have your own quote line of animals, right? So it doesn't, you know, there's no dictionary textbook definition that says, well, when you get to 10 generations of production in, you know, with the same group of animals, that's now your line, right? Like there's no definition for it. So not only do I feel like because there's no sufficient definition for that I might not, that maybe the term doesn't really have much use for me to say that it's from this line, like it maybe once certain really distinguished traits that come from a specific group of my animals, maybe then I'll start saying, well, this is from a line of animals that has this flowing through it. So, you know, maybe then. But the problem with some of these, you know, again, since it has no hard definition, I don't really feel comfortable claiming anything like that because I don't know what I would describe that as. And most people have really different definitions for what constitutes a line, right? And people will just claim, oh, this is my line of animal X or my line of animal Y. And it's like, at least within Uromastics and some of these animals that just haven't been bred in captivity for that long, over that many generations, I really hesitate to use that kind of terminology. You know, maybe at some point I'll be able to say something like that and I'll feel more comfortable saying something like that. But at the moment, it just doesn't fit into my worldview on this. With that said, you know, some of the animals I work with maybe are a little bit easier to parse in that way. So let me explain a little bit. With ornate Uromastics, for example, they're highly polymorphic, which is just to say that they're really variable. So you can have an animal with blue and orange as an adult male, and you can breed it to a female that's blue and orange, and you will get babies, some that are blue and orange, but some that are emerald green, some that are like a sky blue, some that are bicolor, some that have orange on them, some that have don't, some that have yellow, and some, I mean, it's really variable. So at the moment, most of what my breeding with ornate Uromastics is designed to do is that I'm trying to figure out how they're inheriting their color. So that way I can, you know, have a little bit more confidence when I sell someone an animal saying, I'm pretty sure this is going to turn out like X, you know, or like Y. With some of the other species that I have, either all of that goes completely out the window because they breed very, very true to their look, you know? So in the case of like an Egyptian Uromastics, you know what it's going to look like as an adult for the most part. So if something weird hatched out, that would be different. But like they're almost always going to look just elephant gray as adults. So some of that kind of goes away, you know. So there's a lot in there, and it's really hard to pin down and say, well, you know, you're going to get this, or you know, it's my line that I, you know, again, maybe in 25 years, I'll feel more comfortable saying, you know, I still will occasionally purchase import ornates, very rarely, but I will buy them because it adds fresh wild-caught genes into my existing group.
Because there's somebody asked a question on kind of what you just hinting towards what you just said, Ginger Bug. And I want to throw this question in because it ties right into what Kevin asked and genetics. Mm-hmm. Is genetic bottlenecking a consideration of breeding these babies in captivity?
Always. Yeah, always. Right. So this is there's a few things to note here also. So
I'll try. Can they interbreed also? Can like
some of them? Yeah. 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 Many of the species will. I haven't done it, but they will surely hybridize. Yeah, for sure. Definitely. But also separate interesting topic. But specifically with regard to things like genetic bottlenecking and genetic diversity, we know from lots of other animal examples that this is a really important consideration. What we don't know is exactly how many you would need to have like a sufficient population going forward. We have base rules. But, you know, the two things I always try to cite when people talk about genetic diversity and the need for it, one is Fiji, right? The island of Fiji, or the island chain of Fiji, which has Fiji iguanas on it. You'd be hard pressed to convince me that it was like 100 animals that made it to those islands that then evolved into Fiji iguanas. I bet it was a really small number of animals, you know, because of the distance to get to those islands. How many green iguanas made it over floating on debris in the ocean to populate Fiji is probably a small number of animals, right? So there are examples of where low genetic diversity doesn't necessarily seem to be a problem. Another example would be, I have found rock piles in Arizona where it's a tiny rock pile that's like 5 feet by 5 feet or 10 feet by 10 feet, right? Where you look around and there's not mountain ranges for miles, and there are chuckwallas on this rock pile. And so you have to imagine that that group of chuckwallas is relatively isolated and inbreeding kind of relentlessly into the future. And so I think there are aspects of the way we think about genetic diversity and genetic bottlenecking that are actually artifacts of inadequate captive conditions. But then there are real hard examples of what people would call inbreeding depression or genetic bottlenecking, where it's obvious that what's happening is a lack of fresh genetics in the system. Because then when you take an example of an animal with fresh unrelated genes, plug it into that breeding colony, you see increases in viability, right? So it both things are true at the same time, I think. And so with mine, that's one of the reasons I bring in occasional imports into my facility, and I quarantine them for a long time, and then I introduce them into the breeding groups. So that way I'm getting as many possibilities for a ton of diversity as I can. It's also worth noting that when we think about genetic diversity in a wild-caught group of animals, let's say we get an import group of 100 ornate Uromastics, hypothetically speaking, right? The odds of those animals being related are relatively small, just the existing group, because they're not pulling them from a single rock pile in the wild. They're out combing hillsides or whatever to collect a sufficient number of animals to then export for sale, right? So you have to imagine that each individual group is not only relatively unrelated to each other, you also have to assume that each individual import group is very likely coming from a different place. So you might be, you know, if you buy for ornate Uromastics from two import shipments that are 30 years apart, then you could very likely be breeding two animals together whose genetics haven't seen each other in millennia. You understand? Because of how vast their habitat is, from where one end of their range starts to where the other end of their range ends, that entire population, you have animals at one end of it that haven't seen the animals on the other end of it for who knows how long. So there's some level, if you're just even being conscious about buying from different import groups, you are adding in a lot of information. And so there's a lot of potential for a lot of really interesting, there's just new stuff, right? It's just new genes, right? In some way, you're really setting yourself up for success. But, you know, with other animals, you know, if it was a single import group that only ever came in one time into the country, and that's it, and you get six animals from that, like I did with my Sarah Hardwick guy that just came into the country recently, that's enough animals for a little while, but you're probably going to run into some problems in 10 generations. I mean, you might, but there also might be sufficient, you know, it has to do with how much pre-existing genetic diversity is in the animals in the first place, which you have to, there's no way to know that. You just have to breed them and find out, you know? So
you ever I have two questions.
Yeah.
The ornate Uromastic, saying it right?
Ornate Uromastics.
Your ornate Uromastics.
Yep.
What specifically are you breeding for?
Right.
Whenever dealing with those, like, is there a look that you're trying to get a specific shape or, you know, something like that?
Oh, yeah. So right now, I'm mostly just taking animals that look great and breeding them with other animals that look great. And I'm making lots of really diverse pairings, and I change up the pairings almost every year just so I can have a group of animals that are quite diverse, you know, as diverse as possible. I do tend to select and hold back for certain things that I like. Like, I'm always looking at the wild animal as kind of my compass. That's my guiding, like my North Star, right? So any animals that I hatch that look as close as possible to that wild body type, right? Where they have good muscle tone, nice long heads, beautiful long tails, well-formed bodies, I'm trying to pick animals that look like that. Of course you get a ton of variability in there too, but I haven't even reached the point yet where I think next year is going to be the first year where I'm going to make some pairings where it's like a concerted effort to breed animals that were exceptionally colorful to animals that were exceptionally colorful. Right. So I'm only getting to that, and I'm not yet sure, what that's going to look like, because you're talking about animals that are already so beautiful, right? So these ones on screen right now, these are Euromastix J-Rye. They pretty much have two looks. They have a yellow form and a red-orange form, okay? And there's variability inside of that, which is awesome, but you basically know you're going to get one of two forms. With something like an ornate Euromastix, you can get, I mean, it's a straight-up rainbow. You can get so many different looks from the same species. So, you know, they all have a very high potential to be a beautiful adult. I've never really seen an ugly adult ornate Euromastix. So when we think about like phenotypic refinement, which is to say selecting for very good looking animals, you know, whatever, I don't know that that's what it's going to be with ornates. I think they're much more like koi or bonsai trees, where what you're doing is you're breeding for uniqueness. You're breeding, sure. There's always going to be people who want a blue and orange ornate Euromastix. That's what I want. I want the blue one with the orange pattern. Okay, fine. I get it. That's great. But I'm much more interested in seeing what kind of unique color combinations and pattern combinations that can come out of different crosses. I think that's going to be, you know, selecting for animals that produce unique looking animals, I think is going to be more what refining an ornate Euromastix is going to look like, I think, because I think the color intensity, you're just going to get animals that are way more colorful, and you're going to get some that are a little less, but they're all going to be really gorgeous as adults. So I'm less interested in intensity at this point, because I think you can only turn that knob up so much before it starts.
Do you ever get like what might be referred to as a runt or a mutant or something? Huh. You're just like, no way. What is this? You know?
Okay. Yeah. So, all right. So let's split that into two categories, runt and mutant. So let me start with runt. Usually when people are talking about a runt animal, they're referring to an animal that's like weak, or they think is weak, or they think isn't doing very well or is having problems. That's usually what people will call like a runt, right? I have an argument that at least with regard to some of these animals, which are only barely being bred in captivity, where you're only seeing animals that are F1, F2, F3 in captivity, I'm not sure we could really define what a runt is. Because if you have a clutch of 10 lizards that hatches on a Monday, right, 9 of them hatch and get eaten by a bird, right? The last one, that 10th one that hatched on Tuesday, that might be a little slower or a little weaker to get going, might be the only one that didn't get eaten by the bird and then survives to breed later in life. So in the same way that I was talking about like lines as being maybe like an amorphous term that I don't necessarily agree with in whole, I think runt is one of those things too, where there's not like a really clear, hard definition of what a runt is or what it would look like. Because I've had animals that have hatched out that you would think would be a runt, and they end up being the same adult size, or one of the most vigorous animals that I have as an adult, or one of the most colorful animals I have as an adult. And it just, cause it took what, an extra 3 months to get that size, who cares? Right? Like that is meaningless to me. Right. In some ways, but now let's talk about mutants, right? Yeah. Mutants do happen. And so that can happen. That can be everything from an animal that hatches highly deformed, in which case, obviously, you don't breed those animals, right? Like, that's probably, it's very likely to be something temperature-based or nutritional that is a problem, but you also just want to avoid it if it could be something potentially genetic, so I avoid that. But anything that's detrimental to the animal, I'll never select for, right? But I will definitely, I'm very interested in mutants that turn into something really cool. Like, for example, I have I'm working with lavender albino Euromastix J-Rye, which are albino versions of the yellow ones that you just showed the picture of them mating on the screen. Those things, that's a mutant, and that is an unbelievably beautiful lizard. They're one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. They're insane looking, right? So I'll definitely work with those, because I think some of those, I think looking for the anomaly is also an interesting thing too, because an example, you know, that albino J-Rai that I just mentioned, that animal came, that the original animal that was albino was imported from the wild. It was a wild animal. So to me, if it hatches and exists in the wild, then that's technically a naturally occurring kind of that animal, even if it's a mutant, right? So I really like those too. I think those are super cool. I have some other projects that I'm working on that I'm not really at liberty to talk about, but I have a handful of other mutants that are out there that are just really cool, and I'm interested in those also. But I think that they should be, if you're going to choose to work with something that is a mutation, I think you should be working with something that is number one, not detrimental to health, and number two, offers something, right? So for example, let's say you have like the ornate Euromastix, this beautiful multicolored lizard. It wouldn't necessarily make a lot of sense to breed one that's jet black, for example, right? Not because I like melanistic lizards, they're awesome, but you're talking about making an animal that is naturally super, super colorful, and you get one that turns out to be melanistic. It's like, okay, it's kind of cool. It's like an interesting novelty, but there are Euromastix that like those, that's a banded Euromastix. Those things are jet black by their nature. So like, if there's another species that presents that color and is that animal, why make this other species look like another species? Kind of weird, right? So I'm much more interested in, you know, finding a mutation in an animal that would be interesting. So in the example of ornate Euromastix, I could see like an azanthic animal, which is to say an animal that is lacking red and yellow pigmentation, because then what you could say is this animal, I know because it's an azanthic, it is only going to be blue, black, and white, right? Which is pretty cool. That's cool in and of itself, right? Simplifying. If you told me you could get an ornate Euromastix that hatched with pinstripes, where the oscillations and banding that normally goes across the back, if it just went vertically up and down the spine, but it didn't do anything else to the color or the health of the animal, that's pretty cool. That's a unique mutation that would be interesting to see, but it has to be one that, for lack of a better word, like contributes to that animal in some way. Does that make sense?
For sure.
No, that's great.
Cool.
Hey, so I want to ask one more question. I think it has to do with kind of our show. So what are you growing in? What's the medium, the soil that's down below that these reptiles are running on? What's going on down there?
Okay, so the vast majority of substrates that I use, it's just play sand and gravel, some kind of gravel. With some, when I'm setting up a nest, I will use various dirts like repti soil or cocoa fiber or sand mixed with those things, or topsoil or whatever. Anything that will hold a burrow and a little bit of moisture for a little while that they can dig into, deposit their eggs, and feel happy. In some enclosures, I'll mix in Exoterra Stone Desert, like to maybe 20% of it to help, because it's like a clay-based substrate. So it makes the substrate, you know, really natural for where they're coming from. This is an older example of when I used a rock mimicking pond liner as the bedding. But I stopped using that. It's great stuff. It's called Rock on a Roll. I really like that too. I'll put hay in there because they snack on the hay and they'll move through it. And it's just a great little visual barrier. Some of them I'll put cypress mulch in the enclosure, like especially in some of their hiding places where I might want to increase humidity. I'll throw that in there. But I don't, you can tell it's actually quite thin. The bedding is usually only like an inch thick. Sometimes it'll be deeper depending on the enclosure, but I play it really fast and loose with substrates. I'm kind of all over the place, a little inconsistent in a way. I tend to lean on sand and gravel. But as I was telling Mark and Brian before the show, none of what I do is bioactive. So here I am, you know, I'm on a bioactive show.
Yeah.
I don't do any bioactive, but it's not because I don't think it's great. It's because it's exceptionally difficult. I have straight up, and I mean this with all honesty, I've never seen anyone keep a Euromastix in a bioactive setup for a long time. I think it's quite difficult to do, especially if we adhere to like the rigid aquarium definition of bioactive. We don't do anything like that in reptiles, right? But with that in mind, I think it's really hard to do. It's a really difficult thing to do because number one, the really extreme temperature gradients means that you would need really, really deep substrate, which a lot of people aren't really prepared to do. And when they do, you also risk, you know, if you're using super deep bedding and that animal can burrow throughout, then you might never be, you might not be able to access your animal if you need to for health reasons, or in the case of an emergency or something like that, you might not be able to access your animal. The other reason I think it's harder to do is because some uromastics are they'll eat bugs, right? They love things like mealworms and beetles and small little isopods. And I even found a wild photo of one of them eating a scorpion, which was so badass. But, you know, that combination of things makes it a really challenging thing to do. But I would love to see it done. You know, I think there are ways of having maybe a cleanup crew that might be able to assist. But you were mentioning bearded dragons earlier, and they stink so bad when they poo all the time and all this other stuff. Bearded dragons, they shit like multiple times a day, and there's an endless source of food for those organisms, right? And with uromastics, even in the good season, they're going to poop once a day at best, except for babies. And then in for half of the year, for like 6 months out of the year, that animal might not defecate at all. Like, it might just hibernate or brumate for 4 months and not defecate for that whole time. So there's no food in there for your isopods or any of your bugs, right? So that can complicate things. So you'd have to plug stuff into the system, which again isn't necessarily a problem.
So let me ask you this on that point. Could this be where you could incorporate plants, right? Yeah. And compost and stuff like that, like,
right,
where they could eat that in the hibernation period.
Yeah, possibly, yeah.
Possibly take IMO1 from an environment that they're in. Mm-hmm. Try to create it with using that method.
I think both of those things are good options. You know, I think the plant thing was the next thing I was going to talk about, because you know you want plants involved in some way, right? Well, one of the problems with the plants is uromastics are herbivores, so you have to make sure that it's a plant that they can eat and that won't give them problems, or that they won't eat if it will, right? So then that limits your list of plants. Then they have to be plants that are like that are very high heat tolerant. So then that shortens your list of plants that you can put in. And then you add on top of that uromastics they're a heavy bodied lizard. They're small, except for the Egyptians, Moroccans, and Bandids. Most of them are small, but even then, they are brutal on plants. Like, you put a plant in the enclosure and they trample them all day long because they want to climb on them. It's a feature. So you need something that is both climbable and can tolerate that, heat tolerant, low water tolerant, and isn't toxic for the animals in any way, right? So it just really narrows your choices. Doesn't mean they're not out there, right? It totally can, right?
Are you able to establish, like, I know you're breeding, right? So you have tight cultures, you have a lot of cultures, which I really admire, like, mm-hmm. Your integrity in your processes and just your running down of information. Kind of, it seems like you've really done your homework on the pitfalls that could happen. Taking pictures of your mating pairs as documentation to show people what you're doing, and it just speaks to your integrity. So,
thanks.
I love the small cultures. Sorry, that was like a short rant on the small culture setup, but it's a testament to that. So you're in small cultures, but in a perfect world, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if someone has a huge terrarium enclosure, right? Yeah. Where they could set up literally like a moisture gradient type system. Totally. Desert on one side, sand, gravel sand on one side. And then on the other side, maybe an area that's more moist that can and even maybe like it gradients up to thicker. Like, have you seen people raising these guys in that setup?
Or not uromastics. I've seen people do it with like Aki monitors or other animals that have similar temperature requirements. So I know it's doable, but I think it's probably the kind of thing that, you know, so this is a great way of talking. You know, Brian was mentioned in some of the entrepreneurial stuff. This is a great segue into that, and it ties into the bioactive thing, because if I think that it, a lot of it really depends on exactly what your goals are and how your ability to achieve and reach those goals in an effective and efficient, especially financially manner, can limit what your options are, you know? And so if you're keeping one or two animals in a huge enclosure, then by all means, you could get very, very creative with how you could incorporate various plants and smaller organisms, right? You could really, you could definitely go to town. It would just, it's just different when you're doing it at various scales. So the closest thing I've ever gotten to this, other than when I had my Cuban nitinoles, because I had live plants and bugs in there, is occasionally I'll take handfuls of seeds like millet and finch mixtures, and very occasionally I'll throw them in the enclosures. And sometimes I'll bury those in the sand and water them, because when they sprout, a lot of the herbivores will come over and pick at those sprouts, and some of the smaller lizards will burrow under those sprouts, right? So it's great, and it's awesome. And there are ways to do it, but it's very short-lived. It doesn't last. So you could definitely do it. I'm sure you could. It would just take there's layers of experimentation and creativity and complexity that don't fit into exactly the way I'm doing things, because I have all my goals are more related, you know, to making sure I get some good production. And so I try to meet their needs in other ways, right? I try to make sure that they're not so housed solo constantly. It's not solitary confinement. I like to try to vary their diet as much as I can. I change their substrates all the time, right? So I'm constantly adding different bedding, pulling out some old bedding, not necessarily in whole, but in part, right? So if it's an 8-foot enclosure, I'll just get a wild hare one time and just dump a bunch of dirt and sand from a nest box that was used into the side of a giant enclosure and just let the animals play around in it and spread it out throughout the enclosure and do their thing. So there are ways that all the animals are getting in contact with different kinds of microorganisms, different kinds of bacteria, different smells, different textures, different minerals, different consistencies of bedding, different surfaces to run on, different foods to eat, different bugs to eat, different lights, different everything, right? So I really enjoy just throwing shit at the wall and seeing what happens to work or be cool or interesting. It's a very chaotic kind of art. It's like an art-based project, because I was an artist, you know. I went to college for art and design, and that's what I was doing for a long time. So I feel like so much of my the process and the way that I do things is really related to that creative side of my personality. And so it's made it a little bit difficult in some ways to learn that the further I go into this, the more decisions that I really find I have to make purely based maybe not a business perspective, but just from a more holistic perspective, where I'd love to give, you know, I give the animals pretty large cages for someone who does what I do. But I'd love to give them cages that are double the size that I give them now. And I keep them in big 6-foot kiddie pools and big 5x4-foot pens and stuff like that. I keep them in big spaces. But, you know, you're always making those trade-offs, right?
I guess the only reason I ask that is, and it might be rare, right? Uh-huh. You mentioned you sell to zoos. Exactly. So like, I guess like, for a homekeeper, is it normal for them to have more than one of these Euromastiffs?
Yeah, I'd say it's like, I don't know, it's like 50-50, you know. I'd say, well, maybe not. That's maybe too even. Maybe 70-30. So like 70% of the people who buy from me have other animals, have other reptiles. Sometimes, most of the times they have another Euromastix or another Xenogamma or whatever it is. And then 30% approximately are people who have either never owned a Euromastix or some of them have never owned a reptile.
Right. So I guess I ask that kind of question, you know, cause I totally get like the advice that I give to people at home on, setting up their own regenerative pest control system, right. With the product that I sell, which is a biodiversity pack. It's like a consortia of soil-based organisms. Awesome. I give the advice to the people at home that are maybe applying this, you know what I mean, at home. So like for somebody at home who's got one, maybe two of these things, to give them the best life, like would you would you think that being able to give them like a that big of an enclosure, is that obviously that's going to be one way you can give them a better life?
Yeah.
What are like the other things that you can do? I've seen videos of you on Instagram, like interacting with them, kind of like getting them to come to your hand, feed out of your hand.
Yeah.
Like what are the other things that you can do with these animals to give them the best life when you only have, when you only have like the one, or let's say you only have one.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. So great question. You know, basically any of the routine mate care and maintenance behaviors that you perform as a pet owner, you can expand that, that one single thing, whether it's feeding, lighting, caging, climbing, water, outdoor exercise, social interactions, any of those things, there are ways of making it more interesting for the animals. So in the case of caging, it can be providing them a very large cage, a very creatively designed cage, one that incorporates, you know, greater numbers of features to explore and climb on. It can be everything from presenting their food in different ways, making them work for their food, making them climb for their food, making them run for their food, making them find food all over the enclosure in different places. It can be changing where they're going to get their moisture from on a regular basis. It can be, I took one up back in COVID. I took one of my masks off and threw it in the cage for my Egyptian Euromastix, because he would come running over and just explore anything you put in the enclosure. You just look at it. He'd be like, what's this? You know? So you can do things like that. When you've earned their trust and they are pretty tame, you can take them outside. You can, just entertain them in some ways, let them explore things. Novelty's really big. Anything you can do to decrease boredom, the kind of the buzzword is enrichment in herpetoculture. How do you enrich?
Do you think, cause like this is where, Brian talking about his beardy, I know they're different organisms, his beardy chasing down, dairy cows in his enclosures, you know, obviously he can afford a bigger space for it because he's not rearing reptiles.
Yeah.
So it's like kind of a centerpiece in his house more so than an operation like you have.
Yeah.
Do you think, you know, for the people that could incorporate maybe a dry and a wet side, have a huge, I would expect if you only have one of these, even two, right? Mm-hmm. They're going to be a centerpiece in your house. They're going to be like near and dear. You're going to want the best absolute life. So if you have that big, do you see benefit to having something like a dairy cow that's a prolific reproducer, breaks down stuff quick? You're going to have to obviously incorporate that wet and dry side, but like, is that something that is like, what are the concerns beyond?
Yeah.
What you mentioned, are there pests and parasites that they're worried coming from the soil on the wet side?
No, I think if that anyone who's caring about that particular thing is probably a little off. I think the main things you're really going to be worried about, there are probably two or three things. So two base things would be, when you have those large enclosures and you have an animal that's not used to that space, or maybe is transitioning into that space, they can get really freaked out by the newness of it all. And so if you've got like, let's say you have like a 10-foot cage or something like that, right? And on one end, it's like 65 degrees to 75 degrees. And on the other end, it gets 120 degrees like the animal wants. If that animal ventures into that cooler end, it may never reach a peak at a high enough temperature to venture out to the warm side. Right. So you can, it might, right, eventually, but it would have to be very secure in that space and feel like it knows where it needs to go to get all the things. If you just take a brand new animal and you put it in that giant space, it's going to run to the nearest hide and stay in there until it feels secure enough to come out, which could be like weeks, you know? So, you know, that's one consideration. The second,
Brian, are there isopods that you're able to draw out with food source? Cause I know in like the springtail world, in some of my cultures, I'll have like a clay side and a soil side, and I'll be able to draw them across. But I know what you're saying. You're going to have one side. How hot is it on the hot side?
Yeah, it's got to be 125 degrees on the hot side.
Yeah, so that's pretty extreme. Yeah, that's very extreme.
Yeah, and that's like air temperature, you know? So it's got to be like air temperature hot, right? If it's surface temperature, things, you know, it's probably a little too cool on the outside. But so the other feature too, and sorry not to just derail, I'll forget if I...
No, sorry, I had a side thought.
It's all good, it's all good. But like, I think mold growth would be a concern for some folks, like, you know, because sometimes mold can create respiratory infections and things like this. But I don't think it's not doable. I do think it's a thing that someone could manage, but I would just want to see it with a healthy Uromastix that's been living in that enclosure for like 3 years, right? That's where I'd buy it. If someone was like, oh, I've been keeping my Uro in a bioactive enclosure for 3 years, and here's the soil, I'm keeping this kinds of organisms in there that are thriving, and I haven't cleaned up his poop in 3 years, or, you know, whatever, right? Like, that would be really interesting to me. But usually when people come to me and say, oh, I've got a bioactive Uro enclosure, what they really mean is they have a slightly larger enclosure with slightly deeper soil in which they have one kind of cleanup crew and they got their animal 3 months ago. It's like, that's not the same thing. Like, that's not sustainable. That's not definitive. That's very, very surface level. So, you know, I definitely think it's doable. It just takes time. You know, it just takes a long time to see that stuff through, to know if it's working, to work out the quirks and kinks in your system. You know, I just know how much effort that takes. It's way over my head. And so it's just one of those things that I think on average, if their care was a little more conducive to that, it just would mean it would be easier for them. That's why so many people who keep bioactive setups do so with animals that don't have the same extreme temperature and dryness requirements. Right. So, yeah.
So that's a really good answer.
How are you telling an entry person into Uromastix how to clean the cage?
It's really easy. I mean, because they're desert animals, they suck almost all the water they can out of their food. So when they poop, it's just these mostly dry pellets with a little urate. So it's a simple spot cleaning. You just pick it up with paper towel or whatever. If the animal smears some of its poo on the rocks or on the walls, you just clean it with a little bit of soap and water. It's really, they're very low maintenance animals. Like, once they're set, and they're pretty good to go. So they're pretty low maintenance in that regard. The initial setup can be a little bit, right? Because you need a lot of high powered lighting, you know, so you want like big, bright, hot lights. So that can be a little bit challenging for individuals, because it's not the same lower bar for entry for something like a leopard gecko or a crested gecko. But once they're set, they're pretty much set. You're good. You can go away for a week and just leave a head of greens in there, and they'll chomp on it all week long, even as it gets dry. So they're very, very low maintenance pets, which is cool.
Yeah. So let's, we got a couple of community questions here. we'll jump into those.
Yeah.
Caveman wants to know, do Uromastix lay multiple clutches?
Ah, great question. So some of them can. Species like Uromastix princeps and Uromastix thomasi have been known to lay two clutches in a season. I've had them do that, but it tends to be usually a little bit when they're on the more mature side of things. So closer to like 5-6 years old, and as they get up past there, then you can see them double clutch from time to time. The other species, they're generally single clutchers for the whole season. You do get occasional anomalies. Last year, I had an ornate Uromastix lay two clutches in one season. They were pretty back-to-back, which surprised me. I'm guessing that as we see more of them in breeding homes with really excess nutrient diets, and then more animals that have been bred in captivity for a longer period of time, we'll probably see double clutching happen more often, because usually the ability to produce eggs is tied directly to fat stores and fat reserves and stuff like this, right?
So how many in a typical clutch?
So I'd say average of 14, but it can really vary. You can get some early clutches, like when it's their first season or two, where they're like 6 to 8, 9 eggs in a clutch. And then you can get older females. Like I've got one female that I suspect she's 15 plus, probably, because when she came to me, she was already like a very large, mature adult. So, and her first clutch with me was like 23 eggs, You know, that indicates to me that she was pretty old. She's like a very mature lizard, right? But she's been with me for like 8 or 9 years, and every year she lays 20 plus eggs. It's like 21 to 24, somewhere in that range. So they can lay pretty big clutches. Some of the larger species, like the Egyptians and Banded and Moroccan Euromastics, they've been known, again, once they get into that mature end of their breeding lifespan, they can lay huge clutches of like 25 to 30, 32. I think 32 is the biggest clutch I've ever heard of from one of those. But I mean, that they're very rarely bred. So I'm sure it's more variable than that. Yeah.
Is it common for some of them to die or not make it out of the egg?
I wouldn't say it's common. It does happen from time to time, but most of the time, if the breeding animals are in good shape and everybody's squared away, you can usually get, 100% to near 100% hatch rate. But there are lots of factors that can affect that. Like if, especially in a larger clutch, you know, the larger the clutch gets, the more likely you are to see, mortality in some of those eggs. Usually once the babies hatch, it's pretty rare to see a baby lizard die once they hatch, you know, that's pretty uncommon. That usually, if that happens regularly, that means something's wrong. Right. But, most of the mortality will happen in the eggs and it's pretty rare. It's not rare. It's not common. It's kind of like in the middle. It happens from time to time, but if all of your stuff is on point, then usually they most of them do well. Yeah.
How are they breaking that egg open?
They have a little egg tooth that sits right on it's in there and develops when they're in the egg. And when they're ready to hatch, they'll make like a movement with their head that cuts the egg open. Sometimes they make a single slice and make their way through. And some animals will slice like 4 or 5 times and then break their way through. It just depends on the individual, like whatever weird instinct is going on in their mind, you know? It's pretty cool.
So next question is from Gingerbug. Do the blue chins and the blue bellies have a purpose, or do they just prove to be a dino flex?
Yeah. So in this species, this is again Xenogamma tayloriae. I'm sure some of you are familiar with a bearded dragon, and when they're trying to breed and they start head bobbing, their beard, their throat, and some of their chest will turn black. This is the same thing with Xenogamma tayloriae. When the males are trying to breed and show off to the females, their throat turns that brilliant cobalt blue to show off. But it disappears. Like when they're not breeding, they have no blue on them at all, or at least very little. You can't see it really. So it just comes and goes. With the other species, it's all about sexual ornamentation. So the males generally have higher color and have specific color for the sake of display to the females. In some species like Moroccan Euromastics, both males and females are highly colorful. But in other species, the male will on average be more colorful than the female.
So do the females look extra large when they're full of all those eggs?
Is it
obvious that they're pregnant with eggs?
So when they are pregnant, it's pretty obvious, especially as they get right up to when they lay their eggs, they look like a big bag of marbles. Right, you can see the egg shape inside their bellies, but you know they're unlike other lizards. You know, I've had people come to me and say, "Oh, how do you set up nests for a gravid Euromastix?" And some of the first things I ask is, "How do you know she's gravid?" Right, because if you didn't see mating between that animal and a male in the cage, you won't know. You just won't know if she's gravid until she starts digging around and it looks like she's full of marbles. Like that's the only way to know, is when they actually start doing the behavior to try to dig. But a lot of people think you can feel the eggs, but you usually, if you feel something in the belly, you're usually just feeling food mass. You're just feeling the food floating through their digestive tract, because when they're actually gravid, you try to feel the eggs and you can't, because they tense up their belly and the eggs are really soft when they're inside them. So it's a little different there. When you have a very tame animal and they're laying out flat on a stone and you can see the lumps of eggs and you gently run your finger along them, you can feel them, but they feel soft. They're very soft. So, it's kind of hard. It's not super easy to tell, but you can get a look. You can eventually you get,
you can kind of get an eye for it. You're like, oh yeah, that's a gravid lizard. I mean, it's obviously a gravid lizard because their belly can be so distended. But again, usually that's right up when it's pretty close, pretty near them laying eggs.
Sorry, I was trying to find a picture.
Sorry,
this one right here.
So these are chuck wallows. Those are just babies. Babies, chuck wallows are naturally very big and they inflate their bellies with air. So that's why they look so fat right there.
Yeah. So that's not gravid.
No, I would have to, I haven't posted a picture of a gravid animal carrying eggs in a long time. I used to take pictures of that, but it would be six, seven, 8 years ago on my Instagram. Not worth trying to go back for.
All right. So next question, and we look forward to that. And anybody who's listening right now, make sure to check out, we're showing some amazing pictures on here. If you're not actually looking at the screen, so make sure to check out aridsonly.com for some really amazing pictures, probably world-class pictures. Not even zoos have these, so amazing stuff. So next question, what are these spiny tail friends eating?
Yeah, so they're eating mostly mostly greens. So this is gonna, I have really extensive food lists on my care guides, but yeah, you're basically looking at like turnip greens, endive, escarole, collard greens, dandelion greens, grasses, flowers, stuff like this. And then when you can get into, they will occasionally eat things like, you know, carrots, zucchini, yellow squash, butternut squash, but that should be a very minimal part of the diet. And then they'll eat dry, like red lentils and seeds, mostly like bird seed, like finch seed and stuff. They tend to eat that stuff. You don't want to give them a lot of that again, but it is something that they will snack on and will eat. And then they also do consume small amounts of insect food. So they'll eat, I primarily will only feed things like mealworms, like small mealworms or superworms. And, occasionally I'll feed them grasshoppers. But that's about it. And again, that's something that I don't do that much. We're talking 5% of their diet max or so, 5 to 10% maximum of insect matter. And I don't do any fruit whatsoever, no fruit at all, because they just don't ever encounter fruit in the wild. The closest thing they encounter to fruit is seeds. So that's about as far as I'll go. And then, you know, occasionally I throw in like, I'll mix in like prepared foods, like, repcal, juvenile iguana pellets, or, dry, you know, tortoise foods, like pellets, various kinds of iguana stuff. But again, that stuff is like 1% of their diet, very, very little. And usually only during the hot season, like the summer, spring and summer. Oh yeah. And then I'll go pick flowers for them a lot in the spring and summertime. So dandelions and hollyhock and nasturtium and clover. They love flowers. That's their favorite thing.
Awesome.
Yeah.
All right. And last question. This one's coming from Kev. How often do you see bearded dragons living in bioactive setups for years? Or have you seen it?
Yeah. For sure. I've definitely seen that. You know, I think that, maybe one of the people tend to think of bioactive as like this big lofty goal, I think. And so a lot of people maybe can be a little scared of it because they think it's going to be extra complicated for them. I don't think that's the case. I think it's, there are ways of doing it that I've seen that are pretty simple and pretty beautiful, but, with bearded dragons. Yeah. I mean, insofar as I've known lots of people who keep bearded dragons that way and have done so for a long time. So it definitely happens. I'm just not sure. Most of the people that I interact with and work with, most of them don't keep dragons. Some of them do, like for example, Heather Moy and Ron St. Pierre down in Florida, but they also keep all their stuff outside. So it just doesn't apply to them in the same way. This is absolutely bioactive, right? So, but yeah, so exactly. Yeah, kind of a tough one for me to, that's a tough one for me to answer concisely.
So we talked a lot about all the basically, you know, full transparency over there, which lends itself to, again, to your integrity. You're willing to share basically it all, and anyone who's willing to delve down the Euromastic kind of track, I think that they can really lean on you as a resource.
Oh, thanks.
So other than aridsonly.com and at aridsonly on YouTube and IG, where else can people find you, and how do they buy your products?
Yeah, sure. So other than those places, I also have a podcast that I host with Roy Arthur Blodgett of Wellspring Herpetoculture called Project Herpetoculture. And you can find that on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, all the places where you usually get your podcasts. It's under the Animals at Home Network for all the podcast apps. And then on YouTube, it's under Project Herpetoculture. And then in order to buy, there's a couple of ways. Occasionally, I will post available stuff on my website where people, and you can just buy directly through the website. But the vast majority of all my animal sales happens just by way of direct message and email. So just shooting me a message saying, hey, do you have this available? Yes or no. And then go from there. Usually it's really common for people to put down a 50% deposit on something and then get ready for it. But also people contact me and they're ready right away and I can ship to them right away. It's just FedEx overnight shipping. Yeah, super standard. So that's the general way. And then of course, as stuff becomes more, you know, like when I get more of a surplus, that's when I put stuff on the website usually. You know, cause I tend right now, I just tend to have, it's just like it just so happens that the direct message is the way most people do it most of the time.
Amazing information. Really do appreciate you, Philip. And the passion is indistinguishable. I mean, you can't really hide this stuff. So to just get anybody on with passion is really a pleasure. And I don't think that there's any question on that. So
appreciate that.
Yes. Brian, do you want to what's going on in your neck?
Just wrapping up, you know, we went to Cheyenne last week. It's a brand new state for everybody involved in the reptile game, especially in Colorado. Phil, you might want to check that out in time. Yeah. It's only a 2-hour drive, but yeah, shout out to Mr. Critters. We were there last week. And now, you know, my mom just flew in, you know, got here pretty quick to get here for the show tonight. So it's family time. I'm going to, behind the scenes, start to work on some stuff for the future. Phil, I really appreciate you coming on here, man. I don't think enough people realize that, again, back to like more of the entrepreneurship, man, the passion, right? It's just whatever. And again, in the interviews, I saw you say like jiu-jitsu was the only thing that you ever knew. Like, yo, I'm doing this shit. I don't give a fuck what's going on. I'm going to become a black belt.
Yep.
All right. So then you also had this other thing in the background. And that's what I hope that other people will realize. If you just get started, you can still have that going on while you're doing other stuff for your career. Then you had mentioned that you were just doing the reptiles for a while, and then you're back to basically hustling the jiu-jitsu while having your shop with the reptiles. You know, and that gives you more free time for your family, for your newborn. I want more people to have that in life, and I think that's why I talk about it so much, is because in the early days, man, I took a lot of risk, and I think a lot of people involved in this show and in the viewers and stuff took a lot of risk to try to also do that. We just didn't have a college degree. So we're over here doing silly stuff, you know, behind the scenes, and honestly gambling with your life. And so that's why, I mean, a lot of that, like when you look back, is extremely scary. I don't know why we're doing that.
Yeah. Good point.
So to understand that kind of stuff and give back to the community, I just want them to realize that a lot of those skill sets of just being a kind of like a hustler, trying to find your own way, is the same shit in entrepreneurship.
Yeah,
you're not going to figure it out from day one either way. And you're just a shining example of that. Everybody always wants the receipts. And you're one of those people, man, that here you go. Here's the receipts. This guy's finding his own way. He's got two businesses hustling. He's got his family starting to build up. That's exactly what I think most men in their probably 30s or plus, that's what they want in life, man, is to spend more time with their family and be able to take their wife out for a little steak dinner.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with all of that. Very well said.
Kevin?
Yeah, Phil, thank you for being here, man. You definitely know what you're talking about. It's quite obvious when you can sit there and continue just to give all that information. So I appreciate your brain and your time tonight. Thank you very much. I mean, it's got to be a good, Brian, it's got to be a good show for the reptile side because there was so much information given. I mean, it's really good because I was asking the entry-level questions, like just the basic, I don't never done this before. What do I need to know, you know? And I got really good answers. So it'd be a good show to go back and watch again, or at least to tell some of your reptile friends.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, go to okcalyxshop.com, okcalyxshop.com. I've got the IMO3 starter packs on sale for $110. It's got all the inputs, got all the directions, everything you need to make a big old batch or a tote full of IMO3. All you got to do is go out to the yard, gather up the sticks, the twigs, nuts, the bark, and all that stuff. okcalyxshop.com. And then what we haven't mentioned yet is that all three of us are going to be presenting a speech or a lecture with Matt Powers, our soil conference coming up in about, 10 days, 11 days, something like that. It's pretty soon.
Yep.
But I know Mark and Brian and I will all be having a little talk that we're going to give. So check that out. Matt Powers, the Our Soil Conference. That's it, man. Brian or Mark, how about you?
Yeah, I'm super stoked about that Our Soil thing. Not Our Soil thing. I don't mean to say that in a derogatory sense whatsoever. The Our Soil Convention, it's Kevin, myself, Brandon Rust, and God, I can't remember the last guy, but it's the four of us sitting on, I think, like a cannabis panel, which will be really, what an honor to be able to just be a part of anything that Matt's doing and just be a part of the community and to share information. It's a pleasure. It really is. And that's why we do this show. And, you know, the best way that this show is it's a nonprofit, right? It's supported by the three of us. So the only way that you can really support this show is by supporting the three of us in our businesses, and that's really the essence of the show. Is we're just trying to get the best minds like Phil, people with passion. Passion's contagious. So you get somebody with a little bit of burning fire in their ass on the screen talking to other people that are interested enough to listen, and my God, the mountains you can move. It's really awesome. So again, can't thank you enough, Phil, for coming on and just adding to that layer and bringing a completely different skill set to the table. It really is awesome.
Oh, thank you guys. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
For sure, man. A little housekeeping before we sign off. Next week we've got Marco from Marco Is Growing coming on. The week after, we've got Andy from Great Lakes Greece coming on to talk about his regenerative life. This is a guy that lives farming and literally lives outside 365 days of the year. And then the following week, we've got Johnny from Mindfully Rooted coming on, talk about IMO, natural farming, his life in the Pacific Northwest now. And the week after that, we've got Terraganics, Chasa from Terraganics, one of the owners, and really a wealth of knowledge on effective microorganisms will be coming on. And then beyond that, TBD. So we've got a kind of a blank slate for December to fill up, and really appreciate everybody that tunes in week after week, continues to hit the like button, continues to subscribe to this platform, and we love you all, guys. Hope you all have a great week. Keep it regenerative. Stay organic. Good night, y'all.